Of the nasty terms that get applied in bare-knuckle politics, limousine liberal is one of the more memorable. Think of the very image it conjures up. A liberal expressing concern for people who need a hand up in society, but him or herself riding around in fancy cars, probably drinking expensive champagne and eating caviar as well. Steve Fraser explores the history and use of the term in his book, The Limousine Liberal, How an Incendiary Image United the Right and Fractured America. Steve Fraser is a historian, writer, and editor, and co-creator of the American Empire Project, which seeks to expose and understand how a liberal democracy looks to the rest of the world like an empire. Steve's last book, The Age of Acquiescence, looks at how America stopped resisting the encroachment of wealth and power. Steve Fraser, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
So it appears that there are no particularly light and funny topics for you.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. None of this is a laughing matter, right?
So how did you end up specifically on limousine liberals?
Well, actually, it dates back to my previous book, the one you just alluded to, The Age of Acquiescence. At the very end of that book, I write about what I described as the only rebellious movement in the country over the last 30-odd years or so. And I meant by that the Tea Party and the radical right, which has been displaying for some time a kind of rebellious instinct against establishments of various kinds for quite some time. And the Tea Party, most notoriously in and around the financial collapse, our recent financial collapse. So I wanted to write a chapter about that, and I realized when I wrote that chapter, in which I did try to trace some of the history of that right-wing populism, that I could write and should write a whole book about that movement, how it came into being even before the term limousine liberalism was invented.
Well, the term is quite descriptive, and that's probably one of the keys to its power. I mean, and who said it first?
It's first said in 1969 by a guy running for the mayor of New York. He's a Democrat. You know, we're very accustomed to thinking of that term being used by Republicans to stigmatize Democrats. But actually, in 69, this man, Mario Procaccino, who was the city's comptroller, was the Democratic Party's nominee for mayor. And he was running against a man named John Lindsay. Lindsay was, as limousine liberals are supposed to be, to the manor born. His father was an investment banker. He grew up on Park Avenue. He went to all the Tonyist prep schools, St. Paul in New Hampshire. He went to Yale. He got a Yale law degree. He worked for a white shoe law firm. He represented, before he became mayor, the richest congressional district in the country, which is called the Silk Stocking District on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. And he was a Republican. So he and then he gets elected mayor, first in 1965, then he's running again in 69 as the sitting mayor. And what is peculiar about Lindsay, and the reason that Procaccino calls him a limousine liberal, is that he defies everybody's anticipation about what a guy who's driven around in limousines is supposed to do. Instead of defending the status quo, and with those credentials one would have expected him to, instead he is he's calling for all kinds of reforms in racial relations. He's an advocate. He had actually served on the Kerner Commission, which was the commission. He was the vice chairman of the Kerner Commission, which investigated all the ghetto insurrections in the 1960s. He was an advocate of the civil rights, both the voting, the civil rights law and the Voting Rights Act. He was for scatter site housing. He was for a police civilian review board. He was for all these kinds of reforms that we now associate with the 60s, and yet here he was, this kind of Park Avenue, a Mayflower guy. And so what Procaccino said is, look, this guy wants to help the poorest of the poor, but he and his ilk, and Lindsay had a lot of, as you might expect, high-class friends in the major corporations in New York City backed him, the leading Protestant liberal churches backed him, the mass media backed him. And Procaccino said, look, these people want to help the poorest of the poor, African Americans in particular, but they are not about to bear any of the burden of doing that. They're hypocrites. They instead want to have middling sorts, working class, lower middle class, people in the outer boroughs, you know, Queens and the Bronx and Brooklyn, they're going to have to pay the cost. Their kids are going to get bused to schools in order to integrate the schools, while Lindsay's kids are going to go to private school. They live in gated communities. They don't have to ride the subway. They get driven around in limousines. Their income is sheltered in all kinds of tax shelters. So Procaccino's point was these people, Lindsay and others like him, were guilty of hypocrisy. They wanted to help the needy, but not do anything themselves to spoil their own privileged position in society. And that's the origins of that word.
So essentially a disqualifier. They couldn't possibly know the needs of the common person because they're not common themselves.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And Lindsay had a very hostile relationship, for example, with the labor movement in New York, mm-hmm. which was a very strong labor movement.
Yeah, I remember the strikes in the 60s.
The strikes of the 60s, the famous subway strikes, the sanitation there were strikes, teacher strikes. They even had strikes on the drawbridges and removed the fuse boxes so the drawbridges stayed upright. You couldn't pass, go over the rivers. I mean, it was a... Yeah, this is the 60s, so it's a moment of enormous change, and neighborhoods are being overturned, there's urban renewal and all this kind of stuff, and Lindsay is championing that, and meanwhile, Procaccino is exactly the opposite. He's a guy born to a very poor Italian immigrant family from southern Italy. They live in very modest circumstances in the Bronx. He goes to City College, not Yale. He goes to a decent law school, but it isn't Yale. And then he shimmies his way up the kind of Democratic Party machine to become controller. Very, very, and he feels and articulates in his own way the contempt that a lot of people in the outer boroughs felt was being headed their way from these kind of liberal reformers.
All right, so the idea still of some, well, maybe nobody used the term then, but the idea of big government in liberal hands.
Yes, they did use it, absolutely.
Did they really? Mm-hmm. All right. Steve Fraser's our guest. His book is called The Limousine Liberal, How an Incendiary Image United the Right and Fractured America. We're starting at the beginning of the term itself, but it predates the term. You'll hear about that when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange and take your phone calls in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the historian, writer, and editor Steve Fraser. His latest book is called The Limousine Liberal, How an Incendiary Image United the Right and Fractured America. And it is a very image-inducing phrase, limousine liberal. And as you'll find out as we go through this hour, the idea of the limousine liberal actually predates the term and probably limousines themselves. 800-838-3760 if you'd like to join the conversation. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Steve, you call this a surpassingly bizarre metaphor. How so?
I'm sorry?
You call limousine liberal a surpassingly bizarre metaphor.
Yes, it is bizarre because look what it's saying. It's saying that an elite, normally when we think of elites, aristocracies, ruling classes, oligarchies, whatever term we use, plutocracies, you think of them as defending the status quo. And that's almost common sense. That's what we assume they would do. Why wouldn't they? They benefit from it. So what makes this term so bizarre is that these elites turn out to be subversive, overturning the status quo, whether it's about race relations or cultural matters, defending, say, the right to abortion, equal rights for women, and so on. It's a kind of oxymoron. A subversive elite, and this goes way back. If you look at the McCarthy period during the 1950s, McCarthy used the same, he didn't use the phrase limousine liberal, but he might have. He describes people at the very top of the political and economic order, people like Secretary of State Dean Acheson, like John McCloy, who was chairman of the Chase Manhattan Bank and had served during the war as Secretary of the Army, all kinds of people like that. He describes as to the manner born, who have no sympathy with working people, ordinary people, and who are selling the country out to the Russians, to the Soviet Union. He talks of them as subversive. They abandoned China. They're letting the Soviets make incursions into Eastern Europe and so on. They're kind of morally dissolute. They're cosmopolitan types who've lost their connection to the homeland. Some of them are homosexuals. All of these kinds of epithets which describe a cosmopolitan, immoral elite, they all go to the Ivy League, they all work for these Wall Street wolf firms, should be defending America, but are actually selling it out. That's the McCarthy period. But the notion of that goes even further back. Henry Ford, who's one of the great American folk heroes, who might have been elected president in 1920, said he decided to run, actually publishes a series of articles in a paper he controlled, which then became a best-selling book called The Jewish Question. And in that book, he argues that there's an alliance between bankers, Bolsheviks, and Jews. Imagine the oddity of that. Bankers and Bolsheviks, they should be inveterate enemies, but not in Ford's vision of things. He said, look, a new world is being born in which left-wingers are aligned with bankers against the interests of the homeland. They don't have any, they're parasites. They have no interest in productive things. They want to leech off of American industry. You know, Ford hated bankers. He never took a loan out for any of his car companies. He thought of bankers as usurers. And of course, usurers, who's a usurer? A Jew, naturally. And they formed this alliance with Bolsheviks who also wanted to destroy the way modern capitalism was destroying in Ford's eyes. The family, they're behind pulp magazines, they conspired to do the Chicago Black Sox scandal, they're behind the salacious movies that are being produced, they do the bootleg liquor running. In other words, it's a whole modernism that Ford is arguing against and says it's a kind of subversion by elites and leftists and Jews. So that notion, the Jewish part of this equation drops out over time, but the notion that an elite could actually be revolutionary or subversive of the American homeland goes all the way back to the early 20th century.
Steve Fraser's our guest on The Exchange. His book is The Limousine Liberal. Henry Ford in particular, his railing about the elites who control things like the newspaper industry and the movie industry certainly sound familiar to the claims of corporate control of the media that come from the left these days.
That's correct.
So how did the left end up on defense? Where was the jujitsu here?
Well, of course, the left still criticizes the mainstream media as well, even today, depending on how we define the left. But you're quite right, because the big story here is two populisms. That at one point, Ford and guys in the 30s like Father Coughlin or Huey Long, the senator and the governor and senator from Louisiana, they share a lot of left-wing populist complaints about a Wall Street elite that's running the country in its own interests and so on. And they become staunch Roosevelt supporters. But gradually, that legacy of left-wing populism, which dates from the late 19th and early 20th century, sours and becomes increasingly a kind of populism that continues to dislike corporate America, but also begins to scapegoat the vulnerable, whether they're, you know, immigrants or African Americans or today Muslims, or it becomes a kind of right wing, almost without trying to pretend these people are fascist-like kind of populism. We forget that fascism is a popular movement. It enjoys, at one point in the late 1920s and early 1930s, the Nazis are competing with the communists and socialists for voters, for members. They even hold joint demonstrations together, except when they're killing each other on the streets. So there is a kind of crossover between a kind of right-wing and left-wing populism. journalism which makes Ford's denunciation of the mass media sound familiar to the left, and in some ways is familiar to the left. But as that populism evolves, it becomes more and more this version of it, a right wing. That's why today Trump and Bernie Sanders are to some degree competing for the same people, just like the Nazis and the left wing parties in Germany were. And I don't mean to say Bernie is Lenin and Trump is Hitler, but I do mean there's a kind of disaffection that's broad-based. People are victimized by developments in the capitalist economy. They were obviously in the 30s, the Great Depression. They have been again during the last 25 or 30 years of deindustrialization, which has ruined the lives of millions of people in this country, and they've become anti-establishment. Some are drawn to the right, some are drawn to the left.
Well, then that's the point. The point, I guess, is that there's this collection in the middle, because you're talking about you're resenting the corporate overlords who might have sent your job overseas, but you're also resenting the people who might be below you,
exactly,
or were on the income scale, who might be taking your job now.
Yes, that's exactly right. And that's what makes moments like this one both very pregnant with possibilities, some might, which I would welcome, and some which are very scary. Trump is scary, even though I think he will lose heavily in the election, but who knows? And he's scary because he cultivates that. He's obviously a demagogue, and he cultivates those very rancid emotions that pick on the vulnerable as if they were responsible for the problems facing people. But Sanders, on the other hand, is finally calling neoliberal capitalism that we've lived with for now for quite some time to account for the gross inequalities and forms of exploitation and so on that it's responsible for, and that's, to my mind, good.
Steve Fraser is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Limousine Liberal, How an Incendiary Image United the Right and Fractured America. It's obviously leading to a broader discussion of why people get disaffected. So it works not just in the time that the term limousine liberal was created in 1969, but before the term was used, and certainly in today's world as well. Feel free to join this discussion. You might have some observations of your own you'd like to share. Some questions for Steve. 800-838-3760 is the phone number. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So let's get to the first example you actually use in the book, which is Hillary Clinton, not surprisingly, and
right.
What in the eyes of the people who use the term makes her a limousine liberal?
I think she's not to the manner born. She was born to rather in modest circumstances in Chicago, but I think what makes her a limousine liberal and that earns her that sobriquet is that she's an adopted daughter of that elite. She and her husband have become very close with, and this is old news, a kind of Wall Street hedge fund corporate elite that has presided, not only the Clintons, obviously Republicans have presided over this as well, a kind of market-based, free market-based, neoliberal order of things, which has destroyed the lives of people. She's a champion of formal equal rights for all, just the way Lindsay was back in the day. But she, and I'm not personalizing this, but she is not prepared to do much of anything about reconfiguring the distribution of wealth and power and property in this country so as to address the needs of people both who like Trump and the people who like Bernie. And that's been true for a long time. After all, it's under Clinton, her husband, that Wall Street was given its head. You know, that's when Glass-Steagall is abolished. That's when, these Wall Street conquistadors run the show. That's why she gives speeches. I mean, it's telling that she won't release the transcripts of these speeches. It's not surprising because they know her and her circle. I'm not trying to personalize as their friends. She's also earned that because she's a hypocrite. The limousine liberal always raises that image of the hypocrite. She's been for and against about every position you can name, whether it's about fracking or free trade or mass incarceration and not mass incarceration. You go down the line, and and that's why she's earned the enormous distrust that she's earned. I mean, the polls have been showing this for months now. She's distrusted by a lot of people, and she's earned that distrust because she's a changeling, and that's part of the picture of that limousine liberal. They say things about certain kinds of things they don't don't live up. Now, all politicians do that, but she is particularly, she's been around a long time, and she has kind of earned that. And it's why I think the trust for Sanders is as high as it is, because they actually, the guy's been saying the same damn thing for 30 years. Most of the time, nobody listened except in Vermont. But he has this kind of integrity about him, which is rare today in politicians. And also, I think his popularity, look, programmatically, he's not saying anything that isn't a kind of version of somewhat, you know, left-wing New Deal reform. But he is a socialist, and he says it, and he's not afraid to say it, and yet he commands this enormous, passionate following in the millions and millions. That's indicative of a country, in my opinion, anyway, that has become disabused with the way capitalist economy and capitalist culture has operated over the last quarter century, and is ready to say, you know, we want somebody who says that will put capitalism in the dock. And that's why, because in America, you do not say you're socialist if you want to go anywhere in American politics. It's so totally verboten. It has been since 1900, maybe 1920. You just don't do that. Since the Cold War, you do it. It's the end of your career. He's done it. And I think he's done it because people say, you know what, let me look at this again and just see what we really need to do in this country to address the kind of needs, the inequalities and so on that we face.
It's not just the capitalist system that appears to be distributing money a little less evenly across the landscape. There's also the political system and how it uses money, which raises the question if liberals, if anybody really who wants to have any power, is going to end up in limousines because they have to run with the crowd that's funding them.
That's exactly right. And I think this has produced an enormous sense of cynicism and fatalism on the part of the people. They don't feel they participate in the political process, that money talks and only money talks. And I think part of the reason that Sanders is as popular as he is not only because he denounces all of that, but because he hasn't taken any money from these people. So he's not beholden to them. And you can really believe that he actually might try to do something about this horrendous notion that the corporation is a person and has the same free speech rights as everybody else, and therefore just warps, just undermines democracy. And I think that right. And you know, he's had the guts, the courage to say, I won't do that.
I have an interesting email here from Andy in Ashland, who writes about limousine liberals. Steve Fraser's book is The Limousine Liberal. Andy writes, limousine liberals in the last 30 years have successfully used social justice issues to distract voters from neoliberal economic policies. Robert Reich, Thomas Frank, Bill Curry, and others are calling them out for their hypocrisy. I found it easier to talk to independents and conservatives about this than fellow liberals. What do you think is sustaining this liberal denial?
Yeah, I think that man is right. I think because what happened is a dream was born, and it meant a lot to all of us that if you achieved formal equality, equal rights for women, for gays, for African Americans, if you eliminated all the obstacles for all people to formal equality, that was a great heroic crusade, and that it would solve all the problems a kind of liberal society faced. And it began in the 60s, has continued at a lower temperature since then. But it turns out that's not the case, that although one can applaud and should applaud, obviously the ending of Jim Crow is an enormous historic accomplishment, nonetheless, African Americans, for example, live in circumstances in the richest country on earth that no one should be living in. 30 to 40 million people, black and white, work full-time for less than poverty-level wages. Millions of people have been deindustrialized into worse jobs, part-time jobs, or long-term permanent unemployment. None of these issues are addressed by the demand for formal equality. They all have equal rights, but that's not enough. There needs to be, and I think that the people who have worked hard in the equal rights movement have difficulty making that adjustment to saying, look, we also need to address something even scarier, which is the underlying distribution of power and wealth in the economy. And that's, you know, socialism is a commonplace in a good part of the rest of the world, but in America, it's not, and it hasn't been for a very, very long time. And it's scary. I mean, the Cold War has left us, the McCarthyism at home, the Cold War at home, left us with an enormous cultural deficit. That is to say, it actually purged our language, and language, a philosopher once said, is the house of being. If you don't have language, you're homeless, and if you can't any longer talk about plutocrats and oligarchs and socialists and working class and class struggle, and all this gets purged from your language. It used to be a rich part of our language in the 19th and early 20th century, you're sapped of a vision, of an imagination that goes beyond. And I think sometimes these movements that have achieved these social justice accomplishments lack the language to go past it.
Well, it's interesting that Andy puts it that way, and when he quotes Thomas Frank, it reminds me that Thomas Frank's latest book was about what liberals have gotten wrong, and so the accusation at the moment seems to be that they have done the same things the conservatives have done, which is hold up the bauble of, we'll fight for the issues that you believe in conservatives, it's abortion and gay marriage and things like that, and with the liberal side, it's social justice issues, while not taking care of the economic stuff at all.
Yes, I think that's right, and I think they are jointly responsible for this. I think many, many people, look, the limousine liberal is a magical image because it united two kinds of people, two kinds of right-wing conservative people who normally don't speak the same language. One is the Goldwater people, if your listeners can remember that far back. The people who voted for Goldwater and briefly took over the Republican Party in 1964 were the people on the rise. They were entrepreneurial types, real estate developers, shopping mall developers, kind of, you know, high-tech, tied into the military-industrial complex in Southern California. They were people on the rise who believed in free enterprise and hated the big government because of the... Oh, I know you want me to stop, so I'll...
No, you got about another 30 seconds. Go ahead.
While the other part of right-wing populism was back east, where Procaccino was, among lower middle-class and working-class folk who felt abandoned by the Democratic Party. Limousine liberal united these populists from the Democrats with populists, or not populists, but right-wing conservatives in Southern California and the Sun Belt, and both of them hated limousine liberal, which made the right so powerful.
Well, a lot to talk about still. A sore spot in American politics for sure, the limousine liberal. We'll keep poking that sore spot when we come back and talk more with Steve Fraser, and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the historian, writer, and editor, Steve Fraser. He's the author of a new book called The Limousine Liberal, How an Incendiary Image United the Right and Fractured America. We've been talking just in the last few minutes about the issue that some people find with the addressing of social issues left and right and the neglecting of economic issues in the middle, which goes right to the heart of some of the resentment people feel for the so-called limousine liberals. You can join us on the Exchange, 800-838-3760, with your own perceptions and stories. 800-838-3760. Email is jx@jeffnet.org. So a little more along the same vein of the earlier email from Andy. This one was sent in anonymously. This person writes, although I'm a registered Democrat, I've had plenty of these feelings about elites myself. A lot of the people whose values I share when it comes to environmentalism can be a little cringe-making. Sometimes I feel more sympathetic with the right-wingers in my community who don't have huge houses and travel budgets. This issue goes back and forth in my mind on many issues.
Yeah, I think that what's at stake here is sometimes a matter of cultural style. There's a kind of cosmopolitan contempt. It was expressed very vividly during the Procaccino campaign by the Lindsay supporters for just sort of blue collar ordinary people who don't drive exotic cars or are not up to date on all the coffees now available to the average consumer. There's a lot of people who resent their sense of being kind of culturally marginalized by popular culture, by a kind of limousine liberal snobbishness. And I think that, many of these people, once, like perhaps this man, were once loyal members of the New Deal Democratic Party that was inherited from Roosevelt and which championed the economic needs and fought for the material well-being of working people. That Democratic Party began to change dramatically in the 70s and 80s and was taken over. After all, Bill Clinton was head of the Democratic Leadership Council, which transformed the Democratic Party. It gave up a lot of those economic demands or suppressed them and tried to, because after all, Reagan had just won eight years in office. This Republican championing of the free market worried the Democratic Party. So the old populism of the Democratic Party was sort of confined to some attic, and instead you got all this hero worshiping of the free market and the deregulating and privatizing of the economy, both under Republican and Democratic Party auspices. And so people like this man may have felt, this is no longer my party. Then what happened was the Republican Party tried to win them over. Nixon began this by waving the flag of the silent majority. The silent majority was supposed to evoke in people a sense of, here's a party that will defend the American verities, hard work, home ownership, law and order, sexual and marital propriety, patriotism, etc. And the Republican Party, which had for a long time had trouble winning working class allegiance, began to win it because the silent majority, Nixon said, must wage a kind of a version of American class warfare against the limousine liberal who's dominating the Democratic Party. And that worked. It worked really, really well until it didn't, which is now when it bred this silent majority is, of course, now we know, no longer silent. It's very, very loud, and it no longer will tolerate any kind of establishment, including its own, so that what was created by a Republican elite, Nixon and then others after him, in the 70s and 80s and 90s, has turned against its own creator like some Frankensteinian monster, and you have this dismembered Republican Party where Trump is picking up the pieces of that silent majority, now very vocal vocal world, and its resentments.
Well, that's exactly the word I was about to use, is that you're appealing to people's resentments. And when you think about the election of Nixon, it's less at that point. And I would have to go back and look further and figure out if he was not the first person to do it. But you're talking about not just trying to find coalitions of voters, but trying to find coalitions of people who harbor resentments.
Yes, that's
who
right.
Will then vote against the other person and maybe for you accidentally.
Yeah, I think we forget how emotional politics is. You know, we might like it to be, but it never, ever has been a purely rational domain. Why should it be, after all? People, what's at stake here are moral values, questions of justice. These are not simply, can be matters of rational discussion, but they're also invoke in people very strong, visceral feelings. And that's right. And the resentment, the resentment is justified, and yet it gets channeled against people who are not responsible for what's happened to these people. It's justified. You know, if you hollow out the economic well-being of this country, and that's what happened, millions and millions of jobs were lost. People's lives were spoiled. You know, their kids can't even live as well as they can live. These are real things to be resentful about, angry about. But then when politicians turn that resentment, manipulate it against people who are not only not responsible, can't do a damn thing about it, then you're in very dangerous political territory.
Is the answer in your mind for some politicians to say, you know what, I really don't have control over this stuff. I can't make the corporations bring the jobs back onto this shore.
Well, I think, as you could tell from what I've said so far, I'm a Bernie guy. So, you know, I really think he holds out promise because I think he can speak to working class Americans and win some of them over to a position which says, look, you don't have to go after Muslims or Mexicans or black people to address the problems that you're facing.
So let's go back in history a little bit, because I want to go back to Henry Ford. There's
yeah.
an interesting capitalism versus capitalism opposition that comes up in here. What are the branches of capitalism that were at war that he represented?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. I want to make that point. See, around the turn of the 20th century, and Glenn Beck is on to this in his own crazy way, is born what we think of as the modern industrial publicly held corporation, no longer owned by some family, but rather by a universe of anonymous shareholders, and is run, I mean, they own it, and it's run by a kind of impersonal cadre of managers who switch jobs constantly all the time. Ford hated all of that. Ford believed in family capitalism, the older style, 19th century, sometimes small scale, sometimes dynastic capitalism, which had been the main form before 1900. Carnegie runs his steel mill. You know, Rockefeller runs his oil company, and they pass it on down, and they build, you know, Astor ran real estate in New York, you know. These are, you know, Vanderbilt ran the railroads, and they ran them personally and passed them down to their families, and therefore they attached to their property a whole cultural universe of family that we might call it family values, that may have expressed all kinds of provincial prejudices, were tied to certain regions, may have expressed a kind of racism about blacks or immigrants and so on, but it was all in the family. Modern corporate, impersonal, publicly owned capitalism, it takes over in the early 20th century, and Ford and others are at war with it. What the interesting thing is this: most people used to think, well, family capitalism is dead. It died 100 years ago. It never died. And in fact, it's because of the nature of a kind of energetic capitalist economy, by its very nature, gives rise to new entrepreneurial ventures. Some fail, a huge number fail. Some succeed. Some exceed at unprecedented scales. But still, like the Koch brothers, but are still attached to that familial world and want to protect it. And think they have loyalty to not only their family dynastic enterprise, but they think of themselves as kind of Napoleonic, and that they can kind of dictate. Look at who they are. They're conquerors. They've conquered the marketplace. They've conquered other men, and they bring that kind of attitude into politics. And Ford was like that, and didn't like this corporate world that he felt threatened by.
So 50 years after that time, though, I'm still trying to figure out how some of these characters get all stitched together, real or imagined. Like, you got George Wallace running for president in 1976, talking about the silk stocking crowd, the same thing Procaccino had talked about, alongside, and Teddy Roosevelt before him, by the way, alongside candidates who are decrying the hippies and the jobless bomb throwers and the people on welfare.
Yes. Well, of course, Wallace did both.
Yeah.
Wallace did both. And I think what it was, the point I was trying to make earlier, is that you have a lot of this kind of culturally resentful, racially inflected right-wing populism, which hates the pointy-headed bureaucrats. That was one of Wallace's favorite phrases. Spiro Agnew, who was Nixon's vice president until he was convicted of a crime, used to alliterate about all the foibles of these hippies
Nattering nabobs of negativism.
Negativism and so on. That works well among two audiences, both the Goldwater audience, which are not down and out. They have not been hurt by the economy. They're not abandoned by the Democrats, because they always have been Republicans, and they're on the rise. They don't like, but they're culturally provincial. They're kind of dynastic or family capitalist. They're not part of this they resent that cosmopolitan world. They did not go to Yale. They went to some public university, they are completely beholden to the government, but they believe in the free market so religiously that they are blind to that fact. I mean, here they are prospering in the military-industrial complex, which doesn't exist without the government, and yet they're talking the talk of John Birch and of the John Birch Society and Goldwater about the free market and get the government off our backs. So they're caught. Look, politics is a messy business. People say inconsistent things, but they hate this limousine liberal for being elitist and telling everybody else what to do and running this big government. And then Wallace is appealing to this blue-collar guy, you know, as he says, to the barber, the beautician, the mechanic, who also hates them, but hates them not so much because of big government, but because of their championing of racial upheaval and other kinds of things, neighborhood transformation, urban renewal. These things bother the Wallace Thomas supporter, and it's like the guy who says during the Tea Party early days, he says, get the government's hand off my Medicare. Now, you can laugh at that, and it is laughable, but it also has an emotional logic to it. What he's saying is, look, I actually know that I depend on the government or in some way. I'm not some entrepreneur out in Southern California, in Orange County. I can do for myself. I don't live in a gated community. I need the goddamn Medicare, but I hate the government. I hate the big government because it's always intruding. It's telling me how my kids should be taught in school. It's telling me how to run my family. It's telling me, you know, that abortion is okay, et cetera.
So one of the components of the dislike of elites is the argument that that is the common person who knows better what is right for the country.
Yeah.
And that gets you into the you know, the Sarah Palin view that knowing less, being being
right,
almost a true blank slate outsider, makes you more qualified to run things.
Yes.
And so, I mean, does that date back through the,
yes,
the history that you give here as well?
It does. It dates all the way back. This resentment of know-it-all, for example, I'll give you an example that everybody knows about, the Scopes trial, which was, of course, the trial back in the mid-1920s in which Darwinian evolution was brought up for, a teacher was brought to trial for teaching evolutionary theory in his classroom in Tennessee. And what happens there, the court finds the teacher guilty, but what happens there is there's an enormous outpouring of rural and small-town resentment against this teaching of evolution because the people who are doing it are these know-it-alls from urban America, from the Northland. They think everybody, they have no respect for the traditional beliefs of small-town people, and they want to stop that. And a lot of those people who supported who wanted Scopes to be convicted of this crime are kind of the gestation of a kind of right-wing populism. Some of them belong to the Ku Klux Klan, which was an enormous, we think of the Klan as a marginal organization today, which of course it is. It was a mass movement in the 1920s, and it had this same populist inflection. It not only was racist and anti-Catholic, it was also denouncing the big shots.
And it controlled the legislature in Oregon for a time as
it
well.
It did indeed. Yes, mm-hmm. Indeed, and a number of other states.
You know, I'm reminded when you were talking just now about John Lindsay, the mayor of New York, who did win in 1969 re-election, being considered presidential timber for a while. And I remember reading, I think it was in Time magazine, from somebody in the South that said, well, you know, he's from New York City. Down here, that's like being from Red China.
Yeah. That's right. Exactly right. That's exactly right. That's why people like Dean Acheson or John McCloy were thought by the McCarthyites in the 1950s to be Soviet agents, essentially. Either look, John Welch, the founder of the Burt Society, actually calls Eisenhower a willing dupe of international communism. So, yeah.
All kinds of great stuff in the book. It's called The Limousine Liberal, How an Incendiary Image United the Right and Fractured America. Steve Fraser wrote it and joined us today in the exchange. Steve, thanks for a stimulating discussion.
Thanks very much.
All right, take care.